This is Dr. Jay Corsandi, and you're listening to The Best Night Ever, the show that's dedicated to helping you get your best night's sleep. Over the last 20 years of treating patients, I've worn many hats, including dentist, engineer, psychologist, artist, corporate executive, and more. I've found that the key to success, health, and longevity lies in sleep, and that's why I created this show. I want to teach you how to make sleep your best friend. Join me on a journey to uncover cutting-edge science, life-changing tips from renowned experts, ancient and modern sleep secrets, game-changing routines, and lifestyle hacks that will educate, inspire, and ultimately help you get the best night ever. Hey everyone, welcome back to the show, and I've got a really cool episode for you here today. And I want to start the show off by framing the question to you. What's the first thing we say to someone when we hear about something tragic or unfortunate? We generally say, "My heart goes out to you," right? Well, what does that really mean? Well, we're going to learn the science of what that really means because I have the privilege of picking the brain of one of the world's top experts in the field of coherence and the connection between the heart and the brain. His name is Dr. Roland McCrady, and he is the director of research at the HeartMath Institute. He's also the professor at Florida Atlantic University. Dr. McCrady is a psychophysiologist whose interest includes the physiology of emotion, which is fascinating for me. One of his primary areas of focus is the mechanisms by which emotions influence cognitive processes, behavior, health, and the global interconnectivity between people and the Earth's energetic systems. And we are going to talk about all of these topics in this show, so you want to stay tuned. He's been with HeartMath Institute since its founding in 1991 by Doc Childrey. All right, you're going to want to listen closely to Dr. Roland as he goes deep into the world of intricate connections and pathways between the heart and the rest of our body. It's really fascinating stuff here. We talk quite a bit about HRV, which is also known as heart rate variability, and what that means. We also talk about how the heart has its own nervous system. It's called the heart brain, and you're going to be shocked at what it does and how it works. I spent quite a bit of time also talking to Roland about this word coherence and what that means. We also get into some topics regarding energetics, magnetic fields. We also talk about this word Schumann resonance, which people like to throw around a lot these days, and what that really means, as well as entrainment and how we can communicate with others near us and far away from us by using some quantum wizardry. So stay tuned for that. We also talk about some of the tools that you can use to help get you in more coherence. One of the things that I mentioned in the show is called the Inner Balance. It's by HeartMath, and I'll have links to that on my website, sleepbiohacker.com. I've been using it for several weeks. I've already noticed some significant improvements. You'll learn about how it works, what it is. It's very simple. You clip it to your ear, you plug it into your phone, and you do some breathing exercises, which then feedback onto your app and tell you whether you're coherent or not. So very, very cool little app and gadget. And throughout the show, you'll learn how the heart connects to the brain and how breathing in certain ways can make you more coherent, resilient, and a better human being. This show was brought to you by me. And if you'd like to support me in the show, you can find my website at sleepbiohacker.com, which I mentioned, or you can find me on Instagram at sleepbiohacker to learn more about the products that I use and the services that I offer. All right, folks, that's it for now. Sit back, relax, take a deep breath in, and off we go. Okay, we are live. Dr. Roland, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you, Jay. It's great to be here.
So ever since I started my health journey, I've attended a lot of conferences and meetings, and this term heart math was thrown around a lot by people, and I really didn't pay a lot of attention to it. But more recently, you know, it's just been synchronicity or the world. I really started to focus on what this is and dive deeper into it, and I've learned a lot more. But for people who are listening who may have not heard of this term or this organization, can you explain to start what it is and what the mission is?
Sure. That's sometimes a tall order because we're involved in a lot of different aspects of research and working in with humanity. Well, the mission is basically awakening the heart of humanity is really what our mission is. And what HARMath is basically, the simple way I can say it, is a very science-based system of tools, techniques, and technologies that help people better self-regulate. In other words, manage stress and navigate life, day-to-day life, with more grace, more ease. But again, very much based on understanding the physiology of emotion and stress. And a lot of our work in the early years, we're about 30 years old, really had to do with work on understanding how the heart and brain communicate, which led to a term called coherence or heart coherence. And there are now well over 400 independent publications showing that when we learn these techniques to become more coherent, that has a wide range of benefits. Everything from lowering blood pressure and improving hormonal balance and improving sleep, which is probably why we're talking, to increasing performance, whether it's test scores for kids, better able to maintain your composure. If you're in law enforcement or military, we do a lot of work in those populations as well as corporations, a lot of hospitals, we have programs just for physicians who teach these approaches to their patients.
Yeah.
There are about 10,000 trainers around the world now in HARMath.
Yeah. It seems like the applications are almost limitless considering what you do, and probably more relevant than ever now with all of this global pandemic and anxiety and stress and all these things going on. People really could benefit from this. Yeah.
In fact, I just heard last night that I think 1,500 new healthcare professionals have taken our certification courses in the last month and a half. So
it's unbelievable.
Yeah.
So yeah, I'm really excited to speak with you. I've got a bunch of things that I'm curious about. One of them is I was doing some research and you mentioned, well, actually we're all familiar, or a lot of people are familiar now, that the gut has its own brain, you know, called the enteric nervous system. But from what I've learned from you is that the heart has its own brain, which I wasn't aware of. Can you kind of explain a little bit more about that?
Yeah, well, sure. It's absolutely true. And that's not necessarily coming from me, but I'm very plugged into the field of what's called neurocardiology, which is the study of the nervous system within the heart. And a lot of neurocardiology research groups are around the world now. Technically, it's called the intrinsic cardiac nervous system, nicknamed the heart brain in, I think, 1991 by the neurocardiology community. And the nickname heart brain is not just a throw-off metaphor in a way, as the intrinsic cardiac nervous system, the neurons within the heart, literally act like a brain. It's a very complex nervous system with ganglia spread throughout the heart that's all interconnected. And many of these neurons are actually named after neurons in our cranial brain, right? They're very similar. But now many years of research in neurocardiology has shown that the neural structures in the heart have long-term memory, short-term memory, neuroplasticity, neurogenesis, and information processing capability, just like to qualify it as a literal functional brain. Now, here's the interesting part, and this is not new. What I'm about to say might sound like some new discovery, but it's actually been known since the late 1800s, really based on basic anatomy, and that is that the heart sends far more information to the brain than the brain sends to the heart. Now, this is where it becomes different than the enteric nervous system or the gut brain, which is certainly also has a lot of neurons as well, and is its own kind of functional system, but it sends very little information up to the brain relative to the heart. It's more what we would call an effector system, and it's certainly affected by the descending neural systems in the brain. That's how we feel the gut when we're stressed or these types of things. So there's a big difference in the heart-brain communication and the way that the activity of the heart affects cognitive function and even emotional experience between the gut and the brain. And there are even some neural connections between the gut brain and the heart brain, you know, independent of the brain. So it's a complex system that's all interconnected in ways that we're only beginning to understand and uncover.
Yeah. It's so people always say, trust your gut, but maybe now it's trust your heart.
Well, that actually, you're actually right. Well, let me back up a little bit, Jay, because one of the things we heard from massive amounts of people, not just one or two, when they started learning the HARMath skills and the techniques and using them in life, is they were coming back and saying, man, my intuition is like on steroids. And then usually the second thing out of their mouth is, and the synchronicities, it's just crazy, the difference. So we actually embarked on a research journey of studying intuition. And this goes back, and this is all published. There's even meta-analysis now on these studies. But that actually showed that when we really put electrodes on people's heads to measure brain waves and the heart and skin conductance and some other things as well, we were actually able to trace the timing and the flow of what I'll call intuitive information. Now, I won't go into all the gory details. These are very rigorous studies, but basically what we found even surprised us, and that is the heart is the first system to respond before a future unknown stimulus, the heart sends a measurably different neural signal to the brain. Then you get a brain response, right? All before this future event. Then the gut, the body, or the hair on the back of the neck. So it actually is heart, brain, body. Then with the body response, it becomes a conscious feeling, right? Which we call intuition. So the gut gets the credit, you know, or the hair on the back of the neck, but it actually really is heart first in what we would call non-local intuitive intuition experiments.
Is that what you call intuitive guidance?
I do, yeah. So when I, a little brief history here, when I first published this work, this is got in the 1990s, late 90s, I used the language in the, one of the very first papers called, actually called the Electrophysiology of Intuition, part one and part two. There's a lot of data, so we had to publish it in two parts. That the heart appears to have access to a field of information outside the boundaries of time and space. That was the language I used back then.
They call that quantum stuff now, right?
Well, then back then too. And that's why that language was perfectly acceptable back then, because we were showing basically a quantum-like effect there, but only it was in hot, messy organs. Now, at that time, it was only supposed to be, you know, entanglement and these types of processes were only supposed to happen at subatomic scales, you know, photons and electrons and what have you. Now, since then, that's in, even in the quantum physics world, that's we've been blown past that into macroscopic systems of not only just whole atoms, whole groups of atoms and things. So in more recent publications and years, I've kind of come out of the closet a little bit, I guess you could say. And so what is a field of information outside of time and space anyway, right? So I would suggest that it's what, you know, the philosophers and many religions have been talking about. Well, I think the first published book ever talked about this. I learned that the heart actually does have access to what you could call your larger self, or it's what we call it around here to take religious kind of connotations out of it, but a soul, spirit, higher self, whatever. All cultures have their own word for it. So
amazing.
I'm just saying that that's actually literal, not just a metaphor.
Yeah, we're going to get into a little bit more of that down the road here on the podcast with energetics and larger than life type stuff. Yeah. But before we get there, you threw out a term when we first started talking that I think is the crux of heart math, which is coherence. Mm-hmm. And I've been using the devices and the practices and the theories, and I've gotten a good handle on it. But can you explain to people listening what coherence is and what it means?
Yes, I will take a shot at it. So back up a little bit then, because when we use the word coherence, I mean, most people have an intuitive sense of what coherence means. You know, in language, you know, the first definition in most dictionaries has to do with language. Hopefully I'm putting my words together in a way that conveys a coherent meaning, right? So there's something greater than the sum of the individual words that is conveyed, right? And if I'd gotten too much to drink last night, and
kind of you would be incoherent.
And I'm muttering nonsense. I'm incoherent, right?
Correct.
But we also use the term in physics, and it actually has similar meanings. But when we use it in physics and science, it's almost always in the context of describing the behavior of a complex system. Now, certainly us and our bodies or any living system are very complex systems. But it implies that the parts or the subcomponents of any system, first of all, have to be in communication, that there's connectivity among all of the parts, right? And through that interconnection, that they're able to coordinate their behavior in a harmonious and energy efficient way. So when we talk about a coherent system, there's something emerges out of the parts that's greater than the sum of the individual parts, and that it's a harmonious, well-functioning system that has the quality of energy efficiency. Mm-hmm. So within that world of coherence, there are many things we can measure. So coherence is really a high-level term. So like synchronization, entrainment, coordination, you know, are all things that are embraced under coherence. So we spent several years with my scientific advisory board, you know, many years ago, kind of debating what are we going to call this phenomena that we're observing in physiology, which is where all the parts of our body start working together in a harmonious, more energy efficient way.
Okay, that makes sense.
Yeah, and it was coherence, right? Yeah. Physiological coherence or heart coherence, now people tend to call it. And as it probably where you'd want to go next is an easy way to measure that. But that simple way of measuring is reflecting so much complexity that's behind this simple measure is actually measuring the activity of the heart. And that's more technically called heart rate variability. So most people know what heart rate is, of course, Jay, but which is how many times does the heart beat in a minute, heart rate. But in reality, if you look a little deeper, a little closer, what you see is that the heart rate is actually changing with each and every heartbeat. It's this beat-to-beat variability. And that's what's called heart rate variability. And that's a lot harder to measure, right? Because you have to very accurately measure the time between each pair of heartbeats, and well, I won't go into all that. And what you see then, if you look at the beat-to-beat change, which is called instantaneous heart rate, right? That's what it's technically called. You see that the heart is beating out rhythmic patterns. We all heard of a heart rhythm, right? So without beat-to-beat variability, there is no heart rhythm, you know? So, and then what we found that was kind of new to the field was that the pattern of the rhythms, right? If you actually look at not just the how much variability we have is important. That's another subject. But if you look within the variability, you see that you have very different rhythmic patterns. And if we're feeling stress, like anxiety or frustration or impatience or these types of feelings that a lot of people would call negative, we just call them more depleting emotions because that's the effect they have in our body and in our neural systems. You see that when we're experiencing those kind of emotions, that the interactivity among the subsystems in the body are incoherent. They're literally out of sync, not working together in it as harmonious. And that's what we call incoherent rhythms. But when we're feeling things like compassion, appreciation, love, what people tend to call positive emotions, we just call them regenerative emotions because that's the effect they have in physiology, is that the heart beats out a very different pattern. And that's what we call a coherent rhythm. And that basically looks kind of like a sine wave or gentle rolling hills if you look at the rhythm. And then in our, sorry to kind of go on here a little bit, but in our research path, you know, looking at the history of in psychophysiology, which is what our lab is, found that, well, people way back in the early 1970s had identified that the quality or the pattern, as we were able to then show, of the heart rhythms has profound effects on brain function. But again, they didn't know that the heart sends more information to the brain than the other way around, and all the anatomy of all the neural circuits that we know now. And they had actually introduced terms way back then to describe the effects. And those terms were called cortical inhibition. Cortex, part of our brain we get paid to go to work for, right, is inhibited when we have those incoherent rhythms. And the other term was called cortical facilitation. So our, you know, mental capacities are enhanced or facilitated when we're in the coherent rhythms. So anyway, a lot of other stuff's unfolded from that over the years. But hopefully that gives you a basic long answer to your question.
No, those are good. I like these long answers. All right. So we talked about coherence and we talked about HRV. These are two big terms that I'm very intrigued with lately. When you mentioned coherence and the state of interconnectivity and let's say the rhythm balance or what you want to call it like that, would you say is it kind of like meditation? Do you get coherence in meditation? Is meditation coherence? Is it the dropping in meditation?
Well, that's another complex question. Of course, and meditation is a big word. I mean, there are many types and forms of meditation. So yes, in some cases. So the meditations that are more, I would say, heart-focused, you do tend to lead to coherence. The types of meditations that are more what I would technically say are more disassociative don't tend to lead to coherence. So some of the practices like loving kindness, for example, or compassion meditations that has been a tradition for many years in some traditions. In fact, they've studied monks in several countries, and one study found that the practitioners of like compassion meditations and loving kindness, after about 2 years of being a monk, they had shifted their base, what we call their baseline. So their heart rhythms were basically coherent most of the time, just without having to think about it, or not even when they were meditating, after about 2 years, right? And probably, so it took a couple of years to retrain the system into that as your new baseline, as we would call it. With the heart math techniques, we can get people coherent, you know, in minutes of training. Now it takes some time, but not years to shift your baseline of these practices. But the meditations that are more mind-focused and things tend to reduce variability and not really increase coherence. Mm. So it really is driven. It was what we're finding by positive emotions or regenerative emotions and the activity of the heart.
And
that makes sense. So
it's making sense. Yeah, it's all coming together with coherence as well too. Sorry, I got so many questions about this, but with coherence, I notice like when I'm doing these practices that, you know, the heart rate is slowing down. But I've heard you mention before that you can be coherent at a slow rate of heart or a fast heart rate. So how is that possible on like a...
Well, kind of, we can put a lot of meditation techniques would also be relaxation techniques, right? You're trying to relax. And again, there's a lot of meditation approaches, and all meditation is good because you're learning to self-regulate, learning more self-awareness through the body. So it's not, don't misunderstand me. I'm not down on meditation. I'm just saying not all forms of meditation lead to heart coherence. So relaxation by definition is an increase in vagal or descending or what we technically call efferent parasympathetic activity. So it slows heart rate, you know, which we naturally want to do if we're sitting down or resting, these types of things. But we can use techniques to help make that shift. Now, what, as I said, coherence is the pattern of the heart rhythm, right? Well, it's independent of how much variability, but it's also independent of heart rate. So a lot of stress management approaches that are still taught out there are really about calming down this bad guy sympathetic nervous system that increases heart rate. And you do that by relaxing, right? Disassociating or, you know, zoning out, kind of basically disassociating, relaxing. And that's great. It's an important skill you want to have when it's time to do that. However, in a lot of situations in life, it's not time to relax. You got to take care of business. Mm-hmm. Right. If I pop in to see you, right, in an emergency room or something, I don't want you over there while I'm there. I got to chill out here. Probably ought to meander on over there, you know, see if I can get the blood stopped from bleeding and thing. Right. You get my, it's kind of a joke, but it's true. So there are a lot of situations or athletes. I mean, I could go on and on where we want a higher heart rate. It's appropriate, but we want to be coherent.
So would that be like a flow state then if you're in
coherence would enable flow. And actually some studies in Europe have actually shown that coherence underlies to a large degree the bigger flow than just being absorbed in something, how we flow through the challenges of life.
Yeah. Right?
So basically it takes some practice at higher heart rates, but yes. And this is why our work is so popular in law enforcement contexts and military and things, because we're actually able to teach people how to, because think of coherence. Remember, I said it enhances brain function, right? Mm,
yes.
So that's composure. How do we maintain our composure, even at high heart rates?
Cool under pressure kind of thing.
Well, yeah, exactly. Whether that's in a business meeting, you know, or a high stress situation where you're a first responder. So we're very popular, our training in those kind of circles.
I wish I had these techniques 25 years ago when I was in school with the exams and studying.
I'll put up my hand there too, so.
All right, let's move on to HRV. I know we touched on it a little bit. In my world, I'm in this kind of biohacker world where people track their sleep, their fitness, their health with all these different devices. And one of the big topics of conversation is HRV. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people are, how do I hack this? Or how do I get it higher? Is the goal to get HRV higher, or is it is what it is for your age?
Well,
what's the connection there?
Yeah, I would say for most people, the goal is to get it more coherent.
What does that mean?
Well, more into that rhythmic pattern that reflects.
Does that mean better. It goes up?
No, not necessarily.
Okay.
So let's give a little base HRV basics here.
Yeah.
So most HRV metrics, and there are many, many ways you can analyze this speak to beat variability, have to do with measuring how much of it is occurring. Right, so one of the ways you do that is you get all these what are called interbeat intervals, the time between heartbeats, and then you do statistics. And a very popular statistical approach to measuring the variance, how much variation, how much variability is occurring, is called the SDNN, or standard deviation. NN just means they have to be normal heartbeats, no arrhythmias or these types of things, or movement-related artifacts. And so the amount we have, so SDNN, for example, is just a simple statistical measure of all sources that many things in our body lead to this heart to beat variability. That's why it's such a neat place to measure. But anyway, the amount we have is, first of all, very strongly related to age. So we have more of it, this natural variability, when we're young, and it declines with age in a more or less linear relationship. Right. So it's actually one of the best indicators of age, how much of it we have. Okay. So, I mean, and that's taken years to come up with normative databases in health. In fact, we have one of the most reference papers in the field that quantified the amount from age 9 to 99.
So how do you account for, let's say, like my wife and I, we have these sleep trackers and these Fitbits and bio straps and aura rings and all these things. my HRV, my nocturnal HRV score is like 25 and hers is 110 and we're the same age.
Well, I'd have to get into what measure you're talking about.
And, okay. This is the conversations that all of these people that I know.
Yeah, just throwing numbers out without saying what it's a measure of and what is the context by which it's measured and how long was the recording file.
Right.
It's meaningless otherwise.
Gotcha. Okay.
Because the amount, the length of the recording, all of these things, the condition in which it's recorded all have huge impacts on HRV.
Yeah.
Okay. So, but within that age decline, there's a, and that everybody has that. There's no escaping that, that age rate of decline so far anyway. You know, in fact, just a couple of years ago, this is just a little throw in here, a group here in Northern California that funds medical devices and research actually offered a prize, $1 million prize to motivate research into aging. Because very little is really understood about the aging process, right? I mean, there's all these anti-aging conferences, right? But it's all about selling your vitamins and your this and the that. But very little is really understood. So anyway, the metric to win $1 million was HRV.
Wow.
You had to show in an older an animal model, because it was over a couple year period, not enough time to do it in human scale, time scales, that to win the money, you had to show HRV of a younger animal at an older age.
Right.
That was how you, I applied the criteria for that, in fact. But they had determined that was the best measure of aging. Yeah. But anyway, so at any given age, there's a fairly wide, what we would call normative range. So because you've got a lot of variation, so with what makes up the top of that range are the people who are basically doing everything right, more or less. You know, they're on they're eating well, they're getting plenty of sleep, managing their stress. A lot of them will be more athletic inclined. And at the bottom of the still healthy, normal range, I call them couch potatoes. Healthy people, but, you know, they're just kind of, you know, getting through, but they're still healthy. Now, here's the thing, though, I'm using my hands here, a fairly wide normative range. If your HRV for your age is within that, hey, everything's, you know, probably pretty cool. Now, if you drop below the bottom of that mean or range, that is predictive, strongly predictive of future health problems. So one of the big uses of HRV in clinical work is risk prediction. Mm-hmm. So if your HRV is lower, and I mean out below this fairly wide range, we know that you have a pretty substantial greater risk of some future serious health problem. Right? And I mean, you know, like diabetes, heart disease. I mean, the list goes on. Almost every major disease is now correlated with low HRV. And a lot of times, in a lot of situations, the HRV will be low several years, in some cases, before the symptoms manifest. Mm-hmm. So it's a great overall measure of resilience or functional capacity.
Yeah.
Okay. Now within that normative range, right, you can vary around. You're still normal, but it varies around some, right? Not so much usually if you're really good about how you do the measurement, like control, you know, the timing of it and all those things. It's pretty stable day to day, right? But it can vary due to how much stress we've had the day or two before, for example, or how much sleep we got, or how much energy we expended. And this is where it's a lot of in athletics is, you know, supposedly used as a measure of overtraining. We expended more energy than recovered, still in the normal range, but it's a little lower than the days before. So this is kind of an important distinction, because when we say it's lower, it doesn't mean it's crashed down to that level that you're at high risk, right? It's just the normal variation. Now, from my perspective, I mean, we could easily do that in our devices. We don't. So I actually don't think the science is really there yet to really, or at least not enough variables or control to really say, oh, I should train or not train. You know, and we've done some research in that field as well, but maybe not your question, but hopefully I'm helping answer your.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. So let's do an example here. Let's say you're middle-aged male, and you've got some data that says your HRV is below the normal range. And if you know that associates with higher all-cause mortality, how do you then go about addressing it?
It depends. And we do really assessing how much variability we have. The gold standard is 24 hours. I mean, it's called heart rate variability for a reason. It's varying.
It varies, yeah.
It varies in relation to our emotional state, to our physical activity. Lots of things. So if you look at it over a 24-hour period, there's a lot of variability. from, you know, say 1 5-minute walk to another, and daytime, nighttime, all these differences.
But that would average out over the whole day, right?
Well, that's why it's best. The gold standard is over 24 hours.
Gotcha.
But if you just measure it for a minute or 5 minutes, no, you've got too short of a block.
What about these nocturnal monitors?
Well, then you're measuring it during the sleep phase, but not during the daytime.
And there's so you're missing
radical differences between day and night.
16 hours of data. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. So the gold standard is 24 hours.
Okay.
It has to be to really capture all of that. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Yeah. So that if those numbers, and those numbers are pretty stable day to day. I mean, we do analysis for clinics all over the world in the 24 hour measures as part of our research. So, I mean, that's one of the nice things.
Is there a consumer 24 hour monitor that people can buy?
Not that I am aware of. It's one of the things we would actually like to be able to do. Part of the problem there is a good sensor, because you can do it with a good chest strap.
Yeah, it would be a chest strap.
Right? Yeah, we don't use chest straps for clinical work because even they aren't. Our gold standard for measurement is what are called Holter recorders, which you know what those are, I'm sure. But there are, basically you need to have electrodes, and chest straps don't. So they're good enough for heart rate, and they're good enough for HRV if you're not really physically active. But if you're really walking up some stairs and running around, they lose a lot of data and create a lot of noise. But, you know, for a lot of applications, they're good enough. But most consumers will not wear or will not tolerate chest straps. They're not very comfortable. I mean, we've tried it. I wish they would. But
yeah.
So that's continuous, consumer-friendly continuous monitoring is kind of the thing we're all trying to crack of how do we do that. Because once we have that, there's lots of things we can do.
I can imagine the applications would be amazing with that.
Yeah, they are. Like emotional state detection, stress detection, not just risk, you know.
Yeah.
A lot of things we could do.
So let's say you have access to this and you get a 24 hour data set and it's still low. How does then
So what we see clinically, if from people that do these 24 hour tests, is the highest ratio of people with what we'll call low HRV, lower than it should be for their age, is accumulated or long term or chronic stress, whatever you want to call it. That's the number one reason. So what do you do to improve it? Well, you first have to get more self-aware of what's going on, the stressors, you know, because a lot of people, it's become so normal. It's just the way life is. We don't even know that it's stress. And, you know, so I kind of alluded to this earlier, Jay, but stress is kind of a safe word. You're stressing me out, or, right? But what are we really saying? Because underlying that word stress is almost always an emotion. I'm feeling frustrated. I'm feeling overwhelmed.
Anxious.
Time pressure used to be the number one reported stressor, which is actually defined as, if you look at the actual definition of time pressure, it's the feeling that I don't have enough time, or the feeling that everything takes too long. Emotion again, right?
Correct. Feeling,
right? I've seen reports now that the time pressure is like number two. Number one for a lot of people is dealing with difficult people. That's being reported. Isn't that interesting?
I can relate to that. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's the feelings that we have. So if we're really going to learn to manage stress, we, especially us men, need to become a little more open to understanding that, we do have emotions and that they're good. They actually are good things. They're actually what motivate us, but to be a little more out of denial and into some self-awareness of what are we actually feeling? Acknowledge that. And because without that, we can't then take the next step of making some shifts.
Right. Yeah. Because sometimes you can't just throw the stress into a trash bin. You have to be able to manage it or it
accumulates and it crashes our nervous system. I mean, that's what it just does.
Got it. Okay. All right. So, and I've been using one of the HeartMath tools, which is the Inner Balance, which is this little ear clip that plugs into my phone and allows me to do these exercises. Would you say that over time will help with the HRV, or does this help more with the kind of heart-brain connection and like the feelings that you just mentioned?
Well, both. So the devices now, there's a number of them, which measure your heart rate variability. But what we're actually measuring in those is how coherent is the HRV. Some of our devices measure how much at a more professional clinical. So kind of getting back to your question, how do we increase it if it's low? Well, learning to be more coherent in our rhythms helps. So we're stopping the load, if you want to think of it, that's draining the system. You know, a good analogy here, and it's not really an analogy, is if you think of it as energy. And one of the metaphors we use a lot is we have an inner battery, right? And the main way we charge our inner battery, by the way, is sleep, right? So we wake up, we've got our energy level. So then how do we become more intelligent about how we expend the energy we have in our inner battery, and how do we recover the energy? So low HRV basically reflects we've got a really drained battery.
Yeah. That makes great sense. I use the battery analogy every day with my sleep patients. Awesome. I go, if you're having poor sleep, your battery is not recharging.
Yeah, exactly. Which
means you've got nothing left in the day to work with.
Yeah. So coherence is a way of recharging your battery, right? And learning to become more aware and then self-regulate. And the key to the HeartMath approach, which would be another difference in meditation, is that it's about in the moment regulation. What am I feeling right now, and how do I shift that into something that's charging my inner battery rather than draining it? At the end of the day, right, I have more energy to do the things I, you know, enjoy doing rather than going on the couch and drink a glass of wine and turn on the TV and space out. I mean, that's really what it is. It's just about intelligent energy management.
Right.
So now, if you have low HRV, certainly learning to self-regulate, the stress management practices, so the devices, again, long-winded answer here, are really to help train people to make that shift into heart coherence. So if you practice them with the device, oh yeah, there it is. I'm making the shift. So you're starting to learn what that feels like.
Right? It's a biofeedback, right?
It is biofeedback. Yeah, it's biofeedback of the heart, of heart rhythms.
Yeah.
So as you practice, like one of the techniques that comes with the device is called a heart lock-in. So it's actually a type of heart meditation. So if you practice that for a few minutes a day, several times a day, you're starting to teach your nervous brain and nervous system this new state. And we do that long enough, usually about 6 weeks, that becomes the new familiar or the new baseline. So then it's really a lot easier to make those shifts during day to day. So it's not about walking around with a little device, all day long. Am I coherent? No, but it is about training the nervous system and practicing.
Yeah.
So that when you run into that difficult person or something doesn't go our way that stresses us out, we can learn to take that energy and transform that into a coherent energy producing situation.
Yeah. That makes perfect sense. I mean, I've been using it for a couple of weeks now, and I've had obviously some stressful issues come up in the meantime. And I have found myself just, I'm not plugging in the device and clipping it to my ear. I'm actually just doing what that protocol is without using it. And it's helping regulate the situation.
Yeah. Well, perfect.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. So I want to go on to a couple other things here. I know we touched on the heart brain phenomenon. I know I learned as well, and this is something new for me as well, is that the heart has endocrine capabilities.
Yeah.
So can we talk about that? I'm a big fan of oxytocin as well. So,
well, then you'll love this.
Yeah.
So it was in the mid 1980s, actually, that the heart was reclassified as part of the hormonal system or the endocrine system. And the first hormone that was discovered that the heart produces, it's now called atrial peptide. It's been called ANF and BNF, these different factors that the heart produces that have receptors all over the place for those. Like, in fact, when those are increased, it actually inhibits the secretion of cortisol at the level of the adrenal gland. So, and by the way, studies have shown when we're more heart coherent, we increase the secretion of those hormones.
Okay. That's amazing.
So then later, and there's also receptors in the brain, of course, but then later it was discovered that the heart secretes what are called the class of catecholamines, right? Epinephrine or adrenaline, and if you're in Europe, and a whole bunch of those, dopamine, the whole class of catecholamines are also produced by the heart in a rhythmic beat-to-beat pulse cell fashion. Now, that's also important because we know that biological information is not only encoded in the interval between heartbeats, but in the intervals between hormone pulses. So all hormones are released in a pulsing fashion, and information is encoded in the timing between the hormone pulses, not just in the amount of the physical substance. Right. So that was first discovered insulin. So you can give a shot of insulin and it has certainly effects, but if you pulse it in, it has four times the effect.
Oh.
So that's why insulin pumps are so popular, and that pulse it in. And if you change the pattern of the pulses, you change the biological effect of it.
Wow. I mean, that sounds like a big drug delivery system.
Well, it is, but this has been known for quite some time, and that's kind of true of all hormones. So the pulsing pattern of the heart is also encoding information at a hormonal level as well as the amount. But anyway, as the story goes on, then the next discovery was that the heart secretes oxytocin, yeah. Right? In fact, especially when we're younger, the heart secretes as much oxytocin as the brain.
Wow.
Right? And it's probably now in the field of neurocardiology suggesting that the primary neurotransmitter of the intrinsic cardiac nervous system is oxytocin.
Yeah, that's amazing.
Right? So, yes, it's
all right.
The hormonal system. And by the way, when you're in a coherent state, you increase oxytocin production from your heart. And it's pulsed in a more coherent rhythm, which then has even greater biological effects.
I love it. You mentioned encoding in these terms, entrainment and unified field. And these are things that I've become much more curious about. And I've heard things like, you know, what we feel can leave our bodies and affect others. Mm-hmm. So can you explain a little bit more about that phenomenon?
Sure. Well, it's not really a phenomenon.
Or that.
So again, this is part of our research trajectory as we, you know, that kept discovering more and more things about the heart. So when a patient comes to see you, I'm sure you often do electrocardiograms, right?
Uh-huh.
So you put electrodes across the chest to measure what?
Feel.
Electricity.
Yeah.
Right? That's why it's called the electrocardiogram. Mm-hmm. And the heart produces by far the highest source of rhythmic electricity in the body. No question. You can measure the electrocardiogram on your big toe, right? At the top of your head. It's a big signal. Right. But when you're measuring this with your electrodes, what we're actually measuring is current flow.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So we know basic physics, basic science. Whenever you have a flow of current of electricity, you create a magnetic field. Now, the electrodes don't see the magnetic field. They're measuring current flow. Right. But to measure the magnetic component, you use a different device called a magnetometer. Right. Now, in most teaching hospitals, they have magnetometers to measure both brain and heart. It's called the MCG instead of the ECG, right? Magnetocardiogram, right? So a lot of people say the heart doesn't create a magnetic field. Well, it's measured every day, thousands of times around the world in hospitals all over the world with MCGs, right? Yes, it does. And we now know that one of the things about magnetic fields, and my previous career was I was communication engineer for Motorola. So it's something I know a little bit about. So I use cell phone analogies a lot, right? So if I get my cell phone out and I ask, well, how does the message get from my phone to the cell tower? You know, most people say magic, right? No, we know a lot about it. You're using an electromagnetic field to carry the information. Now, it's the magnetic component is why our phones work inside of buildings. They go through things, right? So if you don't think that's true, well, then stop using your cell phone indoors, right? Because it can't work. So easily the magnetic field generated by the current flow of the beating heart easily radiates out into the space around us. And we can measure it up with today's magnetometers. You lose the sensitivity to detect the magnetic field about 3 feet away from the body.
So you're saying there's about a 3 foot diameter?
I'm saying that's how far the current measure, we can measure it with current instruments.
Okay.
I'm not saying it doesn't go farther than that. I'm saying right. Years ago, it would have been 2 feet you could have measured it and so on.
Right.
In fact, I've got a book on my bookshelf back here on bioelectromagnetism where the external magnetic field was accurately measured and even the pattern shape of it in 1886 with a diagram in it from 1886.
Is there variability between people in that magnetic field or is it standard across everybody?
Well, this magnetic field is literally generated by all the cells in the heart contracting at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
So yes, there would be some variability. The bigger the heart, the harder it's contracting, the larger the field will be. It's directly proportional. It's actually directly proportional to the electrocardiogram.
Yeah.
Because it is the current flow that's creating the field.
And what kind of information are these like hospitals gathering when you measure that magnetic field? What kind of information does that give them?
Well, okay. And you do the same thing for the brain. By the way, you can measure a brainwave about an inch outside of the head with the same device, the same sensitivity. So clearly, energetically, the heart is the big, big player here. Yeah. 3 feet, inch, right?
I mean, brain is number two. Okay.
Yeah, by a long shot. By a long shot. So what we have been able to, this was easy to do with our backgrounds. In fact, using the same techniques I would have used back in my Motorola days to look at the information being carried by the field, spectral analysis techniques, you can quite easily show that the magnetic field of the heart is certainly carrying information about our emotional state. So we can tell with about 75% accuracy somebody's emotional state by just looking at the patterns carried by the magnetic field. So probably many other things, but for sure, emotional state. We know that. So your question about what are they looking for, whether you use MCGs or MEGs, by looking at the magnetic field, you can actually say it's a heart issue. You can isolate where within the heart the field is coming from or where there might be an issue.
Ah.
So the same thing with the brain. You can't do that with EEGs or ECGs, right? You just know what the signal is. But if you want to isolate, if you're going to do a surgery or an ablation or something, and you want to know the point source of a certain malrhythm or field, that's when you would use the magnetic.
Wow.
You can go right down to the source, point source, using those where you can't with the electrical.
Got it.
But that's a little irrelevant here. Is what I'm really saying is our emotions aren't something that are contained within us. I mean, of course, we reflect them in our facial expressions and things like that unconsciously, but they're also being radiated into our field environment.
Got it.
And then part two of that research was to see, is the nervous systems of other people able to detect and respond to the information in those fields? And the answer to that was yes. And these were amazingly easy experiments to do in hindsight. When I was shocked that nobody had ever done it before, I said, oh, this had to have been done, did all kinds of searching. And so, no, nobody thought to do it, I guess. So, I mean, but that's common sense, right? We know that. Most people, you know, it's in our language. The tension was so thick in the air, you could cut it with a knife, right?
This is true. It's interesting, yeah. When I do meditation in a group setting, obviously people will say that it's more powerful, it's more impactful. There's a coherence throughout the whole group.
Right.
And thus makes sense that we are actually transmitting without even emoting sometimes, just being in the presence of other people.
Right.
So my question in this case is in this world of social distancing now and this kind of new normal where people are being isolated, how can we still establish that connection?
Well, okay, now we're going to have to go wider, which sure. is even blowing me away and surprising me. So I prefer the term physical distancing, by the way, because we actually don't want to distance socially. We want to
sure.
keep those connections, those heart connections.
Absolutely.
But you're absolutely right. So about every heart math trainer that's out there, that's done group work, will tell you that the people that are training say that it's easier to be in coherence and sustain it when they're in a group setting. So I'm suggesting there is a literal group field. I mean, we've actually measured, you know, way more than 3 feet that hearts and brains between people can synchronize. So I say the field doesn't just go 3 feet, that's the measurement capability. But our physiology is far more sensitive than a $50,000 magnetometer is to detecting the fields of others. So we effectively published this a couple of years ago in groups where you can actually see heart-to-heart synchronization, especially when we like each other. And the more coherent we are, and it's directly proportional, it's statistically related to the amount of what you could call bonding or positive emotion or connections between people. The more we care for each other, like each other, the more we tend to synchronize, literally synchronize with each other. Now, some new work that's just going on, in fact, I was just last week in a conference call with some of our collaborators in Europe, have been doing experiments to show the same thing non-locally. So even if you're at great distances, if you have a strong emotional connection and you're like sending love to somebody, their hearts can synchronize.
Oh, we should have done an experiment right now because you're in Northern California. I'm here in LA.
Well, we're getting ready to set up some fairly well-controlled experiments to really take that to its next level and make that into a publishable. I mean, really ask the question. And probably we'll use Zoom as part of that experiment. And we have an app now as well called the Global Coherence App that allows us to get time-synchronized data amongst people from anywhere in the world. So it's going to enable a whole new world or generation of research.
Yeah.
Like this.
Yeah, I downloaded the app and tried it out. It's pretty cool when you can get into a coherent state and then see on like Google Earth or on a map where other people are doing the exact same thing as you. And you almost can feel this connectiveness, which is really,
yeah,
really cool.
And measuring how coherent you are as a group and a community.
While you're doing it. Yeah. Yeah. Very, very cool. Kind of staying in this a little bit more of the energetics quantum world. People like to throw this term out, you know, Schumann resonance and magnetic fields of the earth. That's something that's been interesting to me as well. Is that part of this whole long distance coherence type situation?
Well, I believe it is. And, you know, kind of following our own data, you know, which started with just what we would call personal coherence, then moving into social coherence, like the In fact, we have training programs now just for teams and groups, because coherence, we can talk about coherence within our own body, personal coherence, but also social coherence within, whether it's a family or a work team or a hospital team. How coherent is that group working together? You know, now each person is part of the more complex system, right? And so we can measure coherence at that level. And then the third kind of window we are now working in, and we call global coherence. So here we're looking at where you're going. So as part of that, we've created what's called the Global Coherence Monitoring System. And these are exquisitely sensitive, specially designed magnetometers around the Earth to measure the actual rhythms and resonances in the Earth's magnetic field. And I wish we didn't have to do this ourselves, but it's the only time-synchronized system in the world that's designed to measure the resonant frequencies in the Earth. There are a lot of magnetometers out there, but they're measuring the amount of the field and the noise on it for like disturbance to protect satellites and power systems. It's important, but it doesn't measure the things that are important for biology for us. So you mentioned Schumann resonances, and there's a lot of hoopla about Schumann resonances these days. And we have the only global system measuring Schumann resonances around the world. But Schumann resonances are not necessarily the most important thing. And a lot of confusion about them. I see, you know, people making all kinds of crazy claims in the internet these days that are just totally not true. So I'm going to start with, if we back up a little bit. So we have the Earth, and it's what's called the geomagnetic field, right? That's the thing our compasses tune into, the north-south pole. So if you time travel back to science class, right, you got to dump iron filings on a glass plate, and you put a magnet under it, right? So what happens is that the iron filings line up and show you the shape of whatever the magnet is that you're using, the magnetic field around that magnet. But if you recall, those iron filings line up in lines, right? Mm-hmm. It's not a homogeneous black blob.
Right.
Very discrete lines. And those are called magnetic field lines, or flux lines, sometimes called. So those are very real things. So the Earth's magnetic, geomagnetic field has the same thing. They're field lines. Okay. Now, one of the things I never really understood until I got into this work is that those magnetic field lines, you can pluck them and they vibrate just like guitar strings, literally. Okay. And what's plucking the strings of Earth is the solar wind rushing by. You know, the Earth turning the solar wind, it's plucking. And so these are really long strings. And so just like a guitar, the length of the string, the tension determines its frequency that it vibrates at. Earth's fields are the same way. Now here's what's wild. I mean, I couldn't believe this when I ran across it. We were not the first to measure this, but we clearly see it in our global system. And these are called field line resonances. Science finally named something practically for what it is, right? One of the primary resonant frequencies of Earth, of its resonant frequencies, the field lines, is 0.1 hertz, okay? So that's exactly the same frequency as the human heart rhythm when we're in a coherent state. Let that soak in. I mean, that's wild. You know, and both have been observed. We knew about the 0.1 in heart, and the people doing geomagnetic work knew about the 0.1 hertz. Nobody just put the two together before. Now, Schumann resonances is something completely different.
Yeah, what's the difference between that and, like, let's say the 7.8 hertz Schumann resonance and, like, theta brain waves? Is that kind of a similarity?
That's where I'm going to go next. But I wanted to talk about field line resonances first because they're the big daddies.
Gotcha.
Magnetically speaking, they're huge that we live in, vibrating. Now, Schumann resonances are a completely different mechanism and source than the magnetic field lines vibrating of Earth. So these Schumann resonances are magnetic waves that are going circling around the surface of the Earth that are trapped between the surface of the Earth and the bottom of what's called the ionosphere. Okay, so the ionosphere, if you're not familiar with that, you can think of it as a big soap bubble around the planet. Right? It's a highly ionized layer of gases, right? That's a plasma, considered the fourth state of matter in physics. Plasmas have some pretty unique things that they do. One of which is they act like a mirror to magnetic waves.
They like bounce off.
They bounce off. In fact, that's how amateur or ham radio operators, you know, work. Yeah. You send your radio wave up, it hits the ionosphere, bounces off. And that's how you're talking to somebody in the United States, is talking to somebody in Europe or China and so on. You get a second bounce, and now they live for that. Now you're talking to people in South Africa and, you know, New Zealand and things like that. But so you get the point. So Schumann resonances are the waves that are bouncing around between the Earth and the ionosphere. And the geometry of that cavity between the Earth and the ionosphere are what can totally control the frequency of the Schumann resonances, right? Just like a magnetron. People don't know what that is, but so as it turns out, there are eight, and here's the other thing people don't get. There are eight of them. There are eight Schumann resonances, not just one. And the first one is 7.83 hertz or 7.82 hertz, which is the same as kind of right in that overlap region between what we think of as low alpha and theta in human brainwaves. But all eight of them overlap brainwave frequencies. Right? So people get enamored with the 7.8, but actually the second harmonic is even higher in amplitude than the 7.8. Mm-hmm. Right? So, and they hear all this kind of hoopla in the internet about the Schumann resonances are increasing. Well, no, they're not. They are exactly the same as they were when they were first measured in 1959 and 1960. And we don't want them to change, right? The ionosphere is critical for life on Earth, right? So if the Schumann resonant frequencies are changing, it means the ionosphere has changed, right?
Right.
Which is not necessarily a good thing. Now, yes, they can bounce around if the Earth gets hit with a solar storm or something that pulls on the ionosphere, you know, and kind of warps its shape a little bit. But as soon as things settle down, they come right back in their normal baseline frequency.
Where are these fields coming from? Because you said the other one was the geomagnetic fields, which are coming from the core of the Earth throughout the planet. Where are these coming from?
Well, what the source, there's a bit some mystery there, but we know that the majority of Schumann resonances come from lightning strikes.
Yeah.
So lightning is striking and it's creating a pulse. So the ones that are resonant that fit the geometry are amplified and become standing waves, and the ones that don't fit the geometry quickly dissipate.
Gotcha.
Just like dropping rocks in a pond, right? If you do it at the right rhythm, the waves are constructive and get bigger and standing. If you do them incoherently, they all interfere and go out to nothing. So it's the same principle.
Yeah, well, that's amazing. It makes a big difference. Like you said, that I was going to ask you about that 0.1 hertz, which I was a little confused about. But
0.1, yeah.
0.1 hertz. Okay, makes more sense now.
Yeah. Right, so that's the field line resonances. Now, I don't know if this means anything, but it's really interesting. If you look, you remember how I talked about how the heart's magnetic field, 3 feet, you can measure a brain an inch? It's the same ratio at the scale of Earth for the field line resonances and the Schumann resonances.
Wow.
Right? Yeah. So, in fact, if you look at the spectrums, you see these really big waves that are field line resonances, same as the heart rhythm. And then writing is this fuzzy stuff on top of that is the Schumann resonances.
Wow. Well, there's synchronicity and coherence right there. Yeah.
I mean, it's, I don't know if it means, it probably does, but you know.
All right. Well, we're going to get close to the end of the show here. And one of the topics that I always like to talk about with my guests is sleep, since this is the Best Night Ever podcast.
Yeah. What a concept.
Yeah. I want to hear your thoughts on all of this and how it relates to sleep. Or if you have a particular sleep practice or sleep hacks that you like to do or recommend. So that's kind of the big question there.
We do. In fact, we have a little book on sleep and how do we sleep better. I mean, we could have actually spent the whole show talking about this topic, but means we don't have much time left. Let me just share this, is that sleep, of course, is the main way we charge during the battery. We already talked about that. But for most people with sleep problems, right, it's not about what's going on at night. It's actually what happened during the day. So it's the carryover effect. So, for example, cortisol, you know, we like to pick on cortisol, nickname it the stress hormone, but it is important. Now, it's interesting. We actually have higher levels of cortisol at night than we do during the daytime. You know, a lot of people kind of ignore this little simple fact, but it's actually true. But if we have too much cortisol production, you know, we're pulsing the system with cortisol throughout the day because of, you know, the stressors, right? You know, my to-do list didn't get done fast enough, or the traffic jams. So we're pulsing the system in cortisol. Now, cortisol is you think of it as a master hormone regulating metabolism. Now, its downstream effects can last 12 hours or longer. So if we were driving home and we got frustrated in traffic, we just pulse our system with extra unneeded cortisol, those downstream effects are way lasting into when we should be going to sleep. But it's basically telling the metabolic system to up the energy, right? So it's hard to sleep. It's at a basic biochemical level. I mean, that's not the only issue here. I mean, a lot of people just can't shut off the mind, the racing thoughts. So what we find is that using actually a device like you've got, getting coherent before going to bed is a huge factor in improving sleep and quality of sleep. It can be that simple. But so really learning to regulate what's going on during the day and getting ourselves coherent before sleep are a couple of really simple ways that can make a big difference. Like we've got data now from thousands of people, you know, well over 12,000 now, where we've done actual pre-post measures in different studies. And maybe one of the big factors that's always reported, maybe out of these hundreds of studies, three or four, you didn't see a significant reporting of improved sleep. So it's, if people will do this, for most people, it's going to work.
I mean, I always tell people your best night's sleep starts the morning you wake up. So it is about all of your activities and stressors and reactions to them. And, you know, obviously light exposure, diet, exercise, all of these things I find funnels down to a good night's sleep.
I agree.
Do you have any special tips or tricks that you do at night that help you sleep?
Well,
hacks.
I practice what I preach. I take a few minutes and get coherent.
Okay.
And I also practice, you know, and it's not about being perfect. I mean, come on. But with increasing ratios, really being able to better kind of flow with, you know, the day-to-day stressors. Don't sweat the little things.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just a shift of perception, and that's easier said than done. But
so. I love it. Well, this has been fascinating. I've learned a ton here. I'm so happy to have had this opportunity to talk with you, and I hope that people really pay attention to a lot of the things you mentioned, and they become a little bit more aware of everything around them, as well as what's going on inside of them. So, Roland, I want to thank you so much for joining me today. This was a blast.
Oh, great. I enjoyed it too.
Well, look forward to talking to you soon. Thanks, Roland.
All right, sounds good, Jay. Have a great day.
OMG. You made it to the end, and we can do a mic drop there because a lot of that stuff blew my mind, and I'm super happy and excited and grateful that I was able to connect with him and share all of this awesome information with all of you awesome people. Just a quick note, if you are interested in learning more about HeartMath or the Inner Balance device, you can learn more on my website, sleepbiohacker.com. I've got a link to order it there directly. It's not that expensive, and there's no monthly going fees or anything like that. You just buy the device, plug it into your phone, and off you go. It's called the Inner Balance. And other than that, I hope you enjoyed the show. If you want to learn more about me, again, you can reach out to sleepbiohacker.com or on my Instagram at sleepbiohacker, where I share all these different tips, tricks, biohacking techniques, and obviously all the ways that I optimize my sleep. I'd also love to hear your feedback on what you think of this show or other shows if you've been listening previously to my episodes. I'm always trying to find guests that think outside the box and bring some real value to all of us. So if you have any feedback or recommendations, please hit me up on social. I'd love to hear from you. All right, folks, thanks again for listening to the show. If you know anybody who would benefit from this information, please forward or share or text or email it or write me a quick review on any podcast platform that you use. That would help me out and the show out just to get the word out and help me get more of these awesome guests to share with you. And with that said, I do hope you have the best night ever. See you next time.
This broadcast is for informational purposes only. Statements and views expressed in this show are not medical advice. The show, including Dr. Jay Corsandi, the co-host, guest, and the producers, disclaim responsibility for any possible adverse effects from the use of any information contained herein. Opinions of the guests are their own. We do not endorse or accept responsibility for statements made by guests, nor do we make any representations or warranties about guest qualifications or credibility. If you think you have a medical problem, please consult a licensed physician.